You can tell. Getting a little spring fever.
Okay, the Economic Development and Housing Budget Division for Wednesday, February 17, 2010 will come to order. We have three bills on the agenda today, and Senator Metzen has Senate File 2167. And I think, Senator Metzen, the two bills that Senator Saltzman has are both in your bill, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
Okay. So, Senator Metzen, go ahead. I believe we heard this bill last year, and we've changed it a little bit, but not too much, I don't think.
That's a good point, Mr. Chairman. I would say this is about 75-80% of the bill that you heard last year. It passed the Minnesota Senate last year in a bipartisan vote of 50-60-11. This bill is designed to create jobs and put people back to work. The need is so great in Minnesota. We have 50% of our construction people are on the bench, not working. This will help get people back to work. Each week, nearly 230,000 people request unemployment benefits in Minnesota. We just heard a report in the Jobs Committee an hour ago from Commissioner McElroy that this number's really about correct, 230,000 to 235,000 people collecting unemployment. Last year, I worked on the Building Jobs with the Building Jobs Coalition, with labor, business, and others to create this language that's in this bill, that's in Senate File 2078. Again, I repeat, it passed on a 50-60-11 vote. I think it would be helpful for the committee members to know Senator Saltzman, Lynch, Senjum, and Bach, and I are carrying this bill. So we do have bipartisan support going forward. This has been work in progress since the last session. We've been listening and working. We've taken a provision or two out of this bill that the governor didn't like. Last year, the House didn't come on board as fast as some of us wanted to, but that's all right. They're on board today with the majority of this bill, and we're very happy for their support. Let me say, Senator Bach has been doing a lot of work with the administration on this bill. Senator Saltzman has been a great advocate, and she has a couple of big initiatives in this bill that maybe I'll let her talk about more than I will. But we have initiatives that build projects, put architects, engineers, contractors, and the trades back to work. If the architects aren't designing anything, and the engineers aren't doing anything, obviously people aren't working. So it filters all the way down. There's a provision for historic rehab tax credits. Now, these historic buildings are all over the state of Minnesota. They're not Twin City historic sites. They're all over. And I'm sure everybody in this room maybe has a building or two that, quite frankly, if we don't pass this tax credit, could be knocked down in the near future, and that history of part of your community would be gone forever. Make some changes in the TIF legislation. It has local entities to be able to do some green and sustainable projects at a local level. There's some permit extensions for projects. Sometimes these things don't get done in a year, so we do extend the permitting. The initiatives that start building the businesses and the economy of Minnesota for the future, these are angel investors and Capco investment. Capco's mainly insurance companies. The governor is on board with these two initiatives, too, Angels and Capco, and Senator Saltzman, I believe, is here, will be speaking on those two issues in the bill. We are here today, I believe, Mr. Chairman, members, due to the fees collected by Deed in the Angel and Capco portions of the bill, and we have someone from the department here today that I think may be able to answer some of the questions why we're before you, but with that, this is well thought out, I believe, legislation and good for the state that will put people back to work. On the angel part of it, we have Jeff Nelson might want to just visit with the committee just a minute, because this does pertain to this committee. He's a senior loan officer with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, so he might just touch on that issue.
Okay, Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Jeff Nelson. I'm with the Office of Business Finance within the Department of Employment and Economic Development. In the Angel bill, Senate file 2307, and also contained in Senator Metzen's bill, Senate file 2167, as part of Article 2 of that bill, there are a number of fees that we would charge to various entities that wish to participate in the program. We have both certification fees and annual fees. The fees vary by the type of entity. For businesses that wish to participate in the Angel program, businesses that wish to be invested in, we would ask that they be charged $150 for their initial certification. For individuals that wish to invest in these companies, and when I speak about individuals, I'm actually referring to the angel investors that are part of this program, we are proposing that they that their fee for certification be $350. And for angel funds that wish to invest in the certified businesses, their fee would be $100. You'll find these fees were derived in working with Senator Saltzman in that we contacted the state of Wisconsin, the Commerce Department. They run a similar angel program in Wisconsin. And we determined that their program, they didn't have an exact dollar cost for running the program, but they said it took 2.2 people for an $18 million program. We estimate that that the program in Senator Saltzman's and Senator Metzen's bill is a somewhat smaller program, approximately $10 million per year. And if just on a strict linear construction there, the cost of running that program would be about 1.2 people. We estimate the cost, not just purely on a person basis, but based on all the equipment, the technology required for someone to operate this program, and we estimate that it would cost about $157,000 to operate this program. So in working with Senator Saltzman, we came up with the fee schedule that I described that in the first year would about cover the costs of running the program. So that's how the fees were derived. We looked at what Wisconsin charged, factored in that we have a somewhat smaller program in Minnesota, and set out the fees accordingly.
Mr. Chairman, I might add that not sure the exact number, but I believe 20 to 25 states, including a lot of our contiguous states, have either Angel Invest the credits and or Capco or one of the one or both of the above, and obviously that's our competition, and we've got people that, we're not going to do it today, but we've got people testify that we're capture a lot of those companies from moving out of our state if we had these tools in our toolbox.
Okay. Is Senator Saltzman coming in here?
She's just outside.
And does she want to say something before we get going here? Does anybody have any questions of Senator Metzen or Mr. Nelson? Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Metzen. And I guess this is kind of a conversation for either you or Senator Saltzman, because I have to tell you, I've been paying a lot of attention to, I don't sit on the on your committee, but there's been a lot of dialogue. And I've been reading the paper even and the articles about that the whole proposition of giving tax credits to stimulate business growth versus having the money available that we are spending on tax credits for other means of, you know, whether it's LGA or whatever it might be. And I do understand the need to try to stimulate jobs. you know, and that you want to, that if we have people working, they can be paying revenue, and there's an upward cycle in causing that to happen. But at the same time, both this year and last year, when we've been at the Humphrey Institute and we've heard from economic experts that don't have, you know, a political bent in this one way or one direction or the other, the message, it seems like to me, that we've mainly heard is that what attracts businesses is having a workforce that's available and well-educated, and the tax credits aren't really a very good way of stimulating job growth. And so, you know, I'm trying to figure out how we can be very, whether this bill, in weighing those, you know, those two things that are kind of at odds with each other, find the right mix, the right balance, to make sure that we're only giving tax credits for investment capital that wouldn't otherwise come to these businesses, and that we're not just giving a break to insurance companies where they might be investing the capital anyway, in which case, to me, that seems like the wrong thing to be doing. So how can we be sure that this money is being very surgically used so that we're not just, you know, further widening the disparity gap, the income disparity gap, and we're actually going to make sure this is creating jobs that does the good purpose thing that you're trying to achieve.
Great.
I appreciate that. I'm going to let Senator Salzman, she's been working very hard on these two areas longer than I have, by the way, so we'll let
Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson. You know, I do want to note that there were many people before me who worked on this. I know Senator Cohen has worked on it. Senator Kelly has worked on it. Senator Rosen has been very involved. Even Senator Langseth carried one of the first provisions for this bill back, I believe, in 2001. And at the time, very few states were doing this. And while we were one of the first to consider it, I think there are 37 other states who have these angel investor credits and are also using a new version of what's been known as this CAPCO bill, the Small Business Investment Act. And the issue is that we absolutely have to continue to invest in education, our higher education institutions. But what we're hearing from also the University of Minnesota is that we put all these dollars into research. We have a beautiful new discovery zone. We are looking at, you know, medical devices, new breakthroughs in Alzheimer, all sorts of areas. We have Dr. Doris Taylor doing amazing work at the U of M that is groundbreaking. And yet when they go to pass the baton, as Vice President Mulcahy says, pass the baton to the private sector or the commercialization process, we don't have the capital to take what is a great idea and take it to the next stage because it requires additional clinical trials, prototypes, research. And that's when banks aren't going to invest in a business like this because it's still an idea. So it's a different kind of economic development than we've probably seen in the past. And it's an area where Minnesota shines, that we are a knowledge economy, that we have been extremely successful in state because of innovation, because of breakthroughs, because of research. But it's a different kind of economic development. So it's not about us using tax incentives to compete with another state. So in other words, if you move your business here, we're going to give you a break on your sort of infrastructure or something like that. It's where we're trying to compete for private capital. And so these kinds of investments are incentives to incentivize behavior that people will invest, take their money. And it lowers the risk a little bit in that we are trying to get a return on investment. So in other words, a person who is a qualified investor, which is qualified by their net worth or annual income, could take $100,000 and maybe say, I'll buy a condo in Florida right now. You know, it's a good deal. Or else they could say, I could put $100,000 into an emerging company in Minnesota, and I'm going to get a tax break for that. But while my dollars are there, because they have to keep the money in the company, they can't just put it in and take it out. While it's there, it's creating jobs, it's growing great ideas, and we're rewarding them for that by giving them a 25% tax credit. So it's really incentivizing people who might invest in other things to say, these are companies that if we don't invest with them, they'll never happen, or they'll go somewhere else. So this is where we really are trying to, and the way the bill is written, the on the angel investor bill, it is very targeted to small companies and who have not received significant capital in the past. And it is proprietary technology because, again, we're trying to target it to some of these areas. The other issue is that we've also made statements that it's for use in the fields of tourism, forestry, mining, or transportation, because we believe there are business ideas throughout the state in some of our traditional economies. So that's where we're really targeting this. It is to companies that right now want to grow, but they can't because they don't have the capital to take the idea to the next level. So I hope that might perhaps begin to answer your question.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman. I think you gave a very good overview of the concept, and I understand the concept, you know, as I said, because, you know, we presented this last year, too. I guess I'm trying to go sort of one step deeper than that and say, okay, we want people to invest in these kinds of businesses in Minnesota. And from what I understand, just having worked on a data practices issue for the University of Minnesota, there are these groups of financiers who are always out there looking for really good, innovative ideas because unlike a condo in Florida, which is a very relatively small investment, if they make wise investments in good, innovative ideas, the profit potential for these kinds of things is huge. And so, yes, they're risky, but there's also a huge upside if they're successful. And so I understand that we want that kind of thing to be happening in Minnesota. I guess I'm just wondering, and I read the article, too, about, you know, what happened in the other body in terms of, you know, kind of the philosophical conversation here about is there good evidence that this works, that this drives investments that wouldn't have been otherwise made, or are we simply giving tax breaks to the highest income earners, you know, and over investments that would have been made otherwise? That's what I'm really looking for is that kind of analysis.
I would be happy to share, and I will tell you that I do not have all of those testifiers here today because it was my understanding that some of what we were working on was going to be the fee structure, so we didn't bring in our whole entourage of people. But I will tell you that just some of the stories you would hear from companies that really want to stay in Minnesota, but in order to stay, couldn't raise the capital, are going across the river, driving right through my district to move to Hudson. Is very, very troubling because they couldn't raise the capital here. They tried desperately to raise the capital here, and they have great ideas, but these incentives are enough to leverage the dollars. We can look at some of the data that has been out there, and I know that some of the people who are questioning this proposal versus a grant proposal have pulled together some statistics. I know that Mr. Michaels in the House put together a report and took off Massachusetts and California because apparently we shouldn't be competing with them, showing how Minnesota is doing compared to these other states. And we look, you know, pretty good next to them. Well, we should look really good next to them, but we should be competing with Massachusetts and California. And so we're taking away the states that, you know, have much of the infrastructure that we also have. And the thing that is also interesting is that Minnesota is still raising significant venture capital. But what's important to note is that only 1% of our venture capital is seed stage. That's between the 50,000 to 2 million investments. And it's often easier for companies to raise 20 million than it is to raise 500,000. And so we are still raising venture capital. When we have the good ideas, that's when everybody wants to invest. It's those small startup companies. That's where the angel credits are really targeted, are these smaller companies that will never exist. So in terms of does it work or not, we're looking at Wisconsin, where they've had success with this program and how many companies have started their growth, what kind of investments. And it's not just the one to four match. It's because people usually put in more than what the match covers. So we can provide that kind of data for you. I don't have it today, though, because we were focused on some of the fee structures with this committee.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saltzman, I'm trying to understand this, and I know we've talked about this before. It doesn't target an industry or try any particular industry, does it? It's just the smaller startup companies, but it doesn't favor one over another. Is that correct?
Senator Saltzman.
Right. Mr. Chair and Senator Vandeveer, right. If you actually look at the bill, I believe it's the second engrossment now, there are some activities that are prohibited. And I believe those start on line 1.22. We then do note that it needs to be a new proprietary technology. We're trying to look at where do we target these dollars. And then we also have a list of other industries, but I believe it says not limited to. These qualified high technology fields includes but are not limited to aerospace, agricultural processing, alternative energy, environmental engineering, food technology, on and on and on. So in fact, we've had a number of people who have said, well, I'm not listed. And we've said, but you're not prohibited either. We didn't want to make this all-inclusive list because we don't know what the next technology might be in 2 years that isn't listed here. So it is not targeted because we believe that we need to make this as broad as possible because we did hear from some states when they became too limited, some idea came forward that was very promising, and they couldn't provide the credit for it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, and that's my objection with a lot of these bills, is that we become, and this doesn't do that, and I like that, because we are not stockbrokers, we're not investment bankers, and we shouldn't be deciding which industry, because, you know, we don't know more than anyone else. So I like that part of it, and, you know, and it's not your fault, but I think we have to do something to make up for the fact that Minnesota does have a very is perceived as having a very hostile business environment, and I think this is a good step in that direction. So thank you.
Appreciate it. You know, I don't know that we are perceived as having a hostile business investment, but I won't get in that discussion.
Mr. Chair,
right now. Okay, Senator Olson.
I just would like to respond to that because I get information, Senator Vandeveer, just like I'm sure you do, you know, during the interim and otherwise. And the U.S. Chamber rated Minnesota either third or fourth in terms of the best business climate in the country. In some material that I received just in the last, since I've been here in the last 3 years. So I'm not quite sure where what that would be based on, or what organization would have said that, but that was the U.S. Chamber.
And we do have 19 Fortune 500 companies in the Twin Cities, which is the largest number of Fortune 500 companies in any state in a metropolitan area of this size. So that sounds like a pretty good business climate to me. But Senator Vandeveer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I haven't seen any of those studies. I'd appreciate seeing that U.S. Chamber. It'd be nice to see one thing good about our business climate.
Thank you. And
I just told you 19.
Thanks, Mr. Colton. Chair. With all due respect, though, coming from small business, 19 Fortune 500 companies, they are often headquartered here. They tend to not be expanding here. And coming from small business, I will tell you it is difficult. There's heavy regulation in the state. There's high taxes in the state. And speaking for my company and many of the people that I know in small business, it's tough to consider expanding in Minnesota.
You know, I just heard another statistic today that there were 236,000 new businesses in the state of Minnesota this year. Micro businesses.
This bill is, Senator Koch and others, is directed to the people, I think, the smaller businesses and not the big ones. And that's why we're kind of focused on this and limited somewhat to the small business community. So,
are there, Senator Dibble?
I have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What's the amendment?
It's the A5 amendment.
Okay.
Or is it going to be distributed?
I'm sorry?
Within our pack?
We're going to distribute the amendment here.
So I'll just briefly describe the amendment, Mr. Chair. It's an amendment. If members want to turn to page 11.
And this is to Senator Metzen's bill, I'm taking it.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
But really, the discussion has been with this is Senator Saltzman's part of it. If you look under qualified green manufacturing, and there's a definition of what that means, this adds to that. So it's kind of expanding our idea of that slightly. You know, it's important, of course, remember Senator Vanderveer's point that this is not limiting. No, it's not limited to just this, but it's putting this idea into statute around what we call green chemistry, which is an emerging and burgeoning field and, you know, pretty exciting. And we actually have some folks who are starting to do some work in Minnesota, and we want more of that. This would simply add to, you know, the energy efficiency, the greenhouse gas issues, the surface water, the biofuels, et cetera, this idea of green chemistry, which is a practice that alters the production processes, redesigns products, et cetera, to lessen toxicity and in promoting human health and the like. When I was on the Green Jobs Task Force, we talked a lot about, you know, what is a green job, what is green manufacturing, et cetera, and we came to a unanimous conclusion that it's pretty much any industry, any job, anything that we do, sometimes it's specifically focused towards energy or, you know, green products and the like. And sometimes it's just reengineering, retooling what we already do in our manufacturing processes to make it better for public health or better for the environment. Mr. Chair, I would like to eliminate lines 14, 15, and 16. That's getting us a little too deep in the weeds.
And you want to just incorporate that?
So just... Yeah, just offer lines 1 through 13. And then we've had some discussion with Senator Saltzman and other stakeholders, and we definitely have a little bit more work to do to refine this a little further. We've agreed to do that between now and the next stop.
Senator
Metzen.
Yeah, Senator Dibble ran this by Senator Saltzman and myself earlier today, and we've looked at it, and we'll accept the amendment now, and there might be some tweaking of the wording later, but we will accept Senator Saltzman's amendment.
But, my goal is that we be expansive and not send limiting language.
So Senator Dibble moves the A5 amendment. Is there any discussion from the committee? Okay, seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Any further amendments, comments, questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one more question on line 11.4, the requirement that the wage for the jobs has to be at least 175% of the federal poverty guideline. I should know what that number is, but off the top of my head, I don't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that number is approximately $18.66 an hour, so approximately $36,000 a year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments, questions from the committee? Anybody in the audience would like to speak for or against this bill?
We've got plenty for it, but I think we're doing all right. So.
Okay. All right, then. Senator Metzen moves Senate File 2167-2 as amended and be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you very much.
Senator Saltzman has these other two bills that you would like to move alongside with this bill to go to the finance, also Senator Saltzman. So if there's no objection from the committee, we will move Senator Metzen Senate File 2307-2 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Saltzman.
So I would think, Mr. Chair, that Senator Dibble's amendment, the A5 amendment, needs to also be inserted into, I believe, 2107, the Angel Investor Credit Bill. Amendment.
Do we know where it goes?
Senator Dibble, do you have an amendment for that by chance?
I didn't. Mr. Chair, I did not catch that we were doing that.
I think it will go. I will take a look here real quickly. I believe it would go.
It's not that amendment.
After line 3.33, after number 5, I think I have the second in Grossman here. I believe that we would insert that as number 6.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, I did have an amendment prepared for you that, and I don't know if it's appropriate, but I just need to change some line numbers. That's the only difference between the two bills.
Very good.
So it would be on page, this is Senate file 2307, page 3, after line 3, we would insert the lines from the A5 amendment on line 1.5, starting with paragraph 6, increase the use of green chemistry, and then all the way down to line 1.13. So we don't have to repeat all of that information. Does that make sense to everyone? It's the same exact language.
I'll move that.
So Senator Dibble will move the his amendment to be inserted into Senate file 2307-2 after line 3.3. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. Senator Metzen then moves that Senate file 2307-2 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. And Senator Metzen moves that Senate file 2306-1 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. Okay. Thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be before your committee, Senator Tomasoni.
I hope it always is.
If you will.
next thing on the agenda, we're going to go over the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. And so we wanted to call in the various departments under our jurisdiction and have us explain the governor's recommendations to us. The first thing we've got is it looks like Deed Palmo. I guess you've all heard that the governor's budget includes a wish and a prayer on health and human services the extended federal Medicare match of $387 million that we don't know if it's available or not because the federal government is dealing with it right now. So that budget we won't be dealing with here. We'll only be looking at the state agency's part, the $181 million that is applicable to this particular budget. And you have a budget document in front of you that is just our part of the budget, and it starts on page 46 of 65, it says. So I don't know if the department has anything more explicit than that to explain to us, or if that's the document you'll be working off of also.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Paul Moe, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Employment and Economic Development, and with me is Cindy Farrell, our Chief Financial Officer. Mr. Chairman, you mentioned the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations, which your agenda references starting on page 48. Is that correct? Do all the members have that?
We've got one that says 46, but you, I guess, let's see, where does yours, where's
Mr. Chairman, I believe our
looks like
piece
you
starts
yeah,
on the,
you
on the
started 48, yeah.
bottom
yep.
half of
yep.
48.
Yep. Okay.
Without objection, if I could
all
work.
Right, and members, just so you can check on your agenda, we actually have the page numbers on the agenda where each particular division starts out. So this does start out on page 48. So, Mr. Moe, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On the bottom half of 48, I'll start with supplemental budget recommendations, and I also believe staff handed out or made available a two-sided spreadsheet that was made available, and I think I will try to refer to back and forth between the supplemental budget recommendations starting page 48 and then where those items are found by line item on the spreadsheet that was made available, and if not, we'll make those available. Okay. Let me start with the kind of an overview of daunting task of being, which at the end of the day will kind of identify about $10 million and where that came from. Some of the factors that played into those kind of decisions being trying to hold harmless, which we did hold harmless, any risk of losing federal match dollars for programs, primarily in the voc rehab area. We did not take any reductions in that because we didn't want to risk our federal match and drawdown of those dollars. It also was the same situation for some small business development money that we get from SBA. We used a state general fund for some part of that funding as well. We didn't make any cuts to that program because we didn't want to risk the federal drawdown of that. So using that as one of the bases in our recommendations. Included with that was maybe past kind of cuts. See that we have in the spreadsheet at least, recommendation for a reduction in jobs because partnership, which is less than some other percentage-wise, if you will, some cuts to programs, and primarily that was because of the nature of the work they do is providing not only income worker but seekers with important training for customized skills that we work closely with the Jobs Plus Partnership Board, obviously, on that and Minsky programs for that. And we took a substantial hit to that in 2008 and in 2010, so that was less harmed by this recommendation. But starting on page 48, general line item there of $1,093,000 is found on line 37, or 8.5 by 14 spreadsheet, line 37, $1,093,000. That's where that number ties into that. And that is the culmination of fiscal 2010. Recommended reductions for a variety of programs, including programs administered by our department and many programs that we work with our partners and stakeholders on. Sometimes these are referred to as pass-through grants or kind of legislative-directed grants. There were some recommended cuts to many of those as well. Moving across left to right on fiscal 2011. $37,000 again, it's $1,602,000. Page 48 of the supplemental budget recommendation.
Mr. Moore, yes. Is this an across-the-board percentage, what's the rationale here?
Mr. Chairman, it was not across-the-board percentage. As one reason I mentioned earlier is we did not want to harm programs like vocational rehab services, so no recommendation was made on that because of the risk of losing some federal match dollars. Other programs had approximately 6 or 7% reductions. Others had less. Some had more.
And is there any anticipation of job loss here?
Mr. Chairman, under this proposal, I believe we are holding some positions vacant. I don't believe it infects any layoffs. There are some vacancies that we will not be able to fill, perhaps one in the trade office, maybe a couple in our state services for the blind.
Did we anticipate filling those positions when we originally allocated the money?
Mr. Chairman, best case scenario, yes, we would have liked to have been able to do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, on page 48, general fund transfer in is $527,000. That can be found on line 42, and that is the addition of $367,000 in FY10. What's the other one? And in addition to that, line 46 of $160,000. Contaminated grants is a $367,000 general fund. Line 46 capital access program is a, if I can take a minute to explain what that program is, it was established some years ago where we provided a limited loan guarantee, a reserve mechanism to local banks, banks throughout the state. That use that reserve fund as an insurance policy against loan losses on enrolled loans. That program was discontinued, at least in funding, some 5 or 6 years ago, I believe. over time, banks have been able to use these reserve funds, but the loss allows for a return of those dollars if there's no activity for a period of 2 years. So this is a return of some state dollars that we matched, dollars put into bank accounts some over a period of now going back more than 10 years ago that we have the authority to take back.
And which, I'm sorry, which that was the capital access program?
Yes, line 46, $160,000 transfer to general fund special revenue account that would come back to the general fund. And then on the down to the operating budget reductions, which is the bottom of page 48 of the supplemental budget recommendations, the bottom of page 48, there's $325,000 general fund operating budget reduction, approximates to 3% of that category. And this will be met by, as I mentioned before, holding some vacant positions open, reducing investments in technology. In expenses, and this will affect several divisions, if you will, in the agency. Mr. Chairman, if I could move on to page 49, supplemental budget recommendations on the top. The 21st Century Minerals Fund transfer. This is a one-time transfer of $5 million. This can be found on line 47 under FY10 on the spreadsheet. 21st Century Minerals Fund, this reduction would not affect any existing project. We have several projects that are actively we're engaged with.
How much money is in the fund then?
A little bit over $10 million right now. So this will leave us $5 million in a little bit for.
I believe $10 million is encumbered already. And so I'm not sure that we can do this one, but go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I understand it's a recommendation.
Okay.
The Section 125 grant funds was a program established a couple years ago. It was originally established at $1 million. It was established using the healthcare access account, and it was intended to provide employers with a mechanism or some offset, some cost for establishing Section 125 plans. Section 125 plans are those that provide a mechanism for employers to pay for health insurance premiums with pre-tax dollars. And what this would do is transfer $998,000 to the general fund and then use that for a budget reduction.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the reduction or elimination essentially of the program, that I think this was part of the health care reform that the legislature and the governor passed in the last couple of years with the idea that this was something that was going to help small businesses provide health insurance for their employees. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I believe that was part of that package.
And the 125 plans, are those commonly called the high deductible HSA type plans? Is that what it's referring to? Or is it not limited to just those types of plans?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I might have to refer to one of our staff to help with that question. If I could call on Mark to...
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Loftus with DEET. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know if it goes by that name. This is a program that a company who cannot otherwise afford to pay for insurance for their employees would allow the employees to create their own program and deduct into it. So it's like a health savings account, but I don't know if it goes by that name.
Well,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not worried about technically what the name is. I guess I'm just wondering if this type of plan is for any type of insurance that would qualify, or if it's the type of insurance that is the high deductible HSA type of plan, which is usually partnered with this kind of a tax deduction. I believe what this was for was to allow small businesses the opportunity to take advantage of setting up. If it's the high deductible HSA, it's not really a type of insurance I like, but at least it's a more affordable kind of insurance, as opposed to and kind of being able to mirror what larger businesses can do. And I'd just like to say for the record that if we're worried about jobs, and particularly jobs with small businesses, that one of the things that really makes it difficult for small businesses to keep employees, and I've heard this over and over again from small businesses in my area, is the ability to provide health insurance for their employees. Because health insurance costs have gotten so high, a lot of times employer doesn't provide the insurance anymore, and the employee ends up going somewhere else or going without health insurance, which then adds more cost to the system somewhere else. So I guess I would just say that even if this is for the high deductible plan as opposed to any kind of plan, I don't particularly favor that kind of insurance, but the concept is still a good one, helping small businesses be able to provide insurance for their employees. And it seems to me that if we take this deduction, we're just going to be shifting those costs somewhere else, and we're going to be hurting small businesses, who we say we're trying to help.
And it's $1 million coming out of the healthcare access fund into the general fund. So you're right. Senator Vandiver?
Well, Mr. Chair, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is this just eliminating the grants of $350 to employers to help them establish it? It's not eliminating their ability to do it or anything. So is it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandiver, right. This was up to a $350 grant to help employers establish these accounts through accounting and other kind of accounting mechanisms. Yeah.
And I don't know what country you guys are living in, but we have to cut something. And this certainly, it is not cutting somebody's insurance. And so it seems extremely reasonable. If you're going to have trouble with this, I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Senator Olson.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair and Senator Vandiver, I think the idea is to try to make cuts that make sense in terms of rather than pushing costs to small businesses or pushing costs to others or perhaps even increasing costs. The idea was that a lot of times small businesses are not able to absorb these costs like larger businesses can because it's expensive to set up these plans. So that's why this was part of the health care reform, because it actually is going to save money overall. And so I think we do have a responsibility, especially since it is just $1 million, if it ends up creating a policy that's relatively inexpensive for the benefit that it achieves, then it may not be a very wise thing to cut.
Senator Andrew.
Just $1 million. I don't know if you know what your constituents do for $1 million, but I know what mine do. And $1 million is $1 million every day of the week. It's a good start.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Vandiver, it's easy to demagogue about those kinds of numbers, but what I'm talking about is in relation to a multi-billion-dollar budget and the impact that $1 million can make for these small businesses. So it's $350 that will have to be added on to their costs, and I think even that $350 is significant for these small businesses.
Mr. Moe, continue.
Mr. Chair, the next item on page 49, application fee infrastructure program, you will not find on the spreadsheet, and I'll just comment on this briefly. It's a work in process. We had proposed to merge two bonding programs that we had in our department, the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure, the Bioscience Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, into a single statewide program. Neither that nor this fee ended up in either the House or Senate version of the bonding bill. It is still a work in process, but it's something we had proposed to kind of help offset some of the overhead cost of administering what we had hoped for at the time of recommendations, a $25 million bonding program. Further on, the unemployment insurance, UI, stands for Unemployment State Administration Transfer. This is an $80,000 transfer to the general fund. from a special revenue account that we establish under the unemployment insurance program. It is an account that receives penalty and interest that we receive on fraud and other cases with unemployment insurance employers and employees. And the $80,000 transfer would be a one-time transfer to the general fund. And we can mitigate this transfer by additional resources we received in what we call an above-base grant from the federal government in administering our unemployment insurance program. With the volume and activity in that program, we've had additional resources from the federal government to help offset some of this. The operating budget reduction on allotment ramification is just a continuation of the 2010 governor's unallotment plan into 11, 12, and 13, which is identified there in the very bottom. And then the bottom line there. The spreadsheet shows, if you look on page, right after line 53, the total of 10,317,000 cuts, including all the ones identified here. I will stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe just I don't know if you have this, or maybe it's on the balance sheet or somewhere, and pretty easily. How much of it is ongoing and how much of it is one-time? I don't know if you got that or not.
I can, in one moment, I think I can help with that.
The ongoing portion would be...
Our ongoing portion of that would be $4.4 million, approximately, and $5.2 would be one-time.
Is that on the line here?
No, I would have to go.
I see. On line, looks like on line 48 under column O. Is that your one time?
That would be 5.2 million one time, right.
Okay, and then the 3.8 on line 53.
Yeah, I missed something. Line 48, column O, 5.2 million, and then you'd have to add the healthcare access, 998,000. That would be the one time.
So the 10.3 is the one time then?
10.3 is the total, and if we back off the 5.2 on line 48 and back off the healthcare access 998, the difference would be the ongoing.
Okay, and that should be the 3.8 that's on column P, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Are there any questions? That concludes your presentation.
Senator Olson. Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back one more time to the healthcare access, the proposal to cut that $998,000, I'm just wondering whether the legislature told DEED to make these grants to employers, and it looks like about half the time's gone by, I guess a little less than half the time, maybe 30 to 40% of the time that's gone by, and hardly any money has been distributed. So is there a reason for that? Are people not utilizing this because they don't want it, or why haven't we been distributing this grant?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'll take a crack at that. First of all, it was a complicated, even though it's only $350, it's a complicated mechanism to set up with the Department of Health and Department of Human Services, who also have a stake in the health care program. So it took us a while for the legal structure of it to be put in place, and we tried to market it through local chambers, through local small business development centers to make it known and have it on our website as well. And we found that a number of companies that we talked to said it's too much work for us to apply for the grant, for the $350 grant. So we found it to be, if it had been a larger grant perhaps, it would have been more interest in applying for it to set up a program. They set up a program, they document it to us, we fill out the paperwork and issue them a check. And for the most part, a lot of people who fill it out have been people who provide employer services for companies. It's probably been six or seven grants that we've done. So very somewhat cumbersome, I think.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of follow-up questions for that. One is, how long has that grant been available where you've actually had this everything up and running so that you were ready to receive those applications? And number two, why did you set up such a cumbersome process? Couldn't it have been made less cumbersome?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think, I can't remember the exact date, but it was sometime last late summer, early fall, that we had these in place. I'd have to check that. I couldn't be sure about that. But it took us several months to work with the other agencies to get it in place. The second part, the second question of could we have made it easier, we made it as simple as possible. We had a most state grant and loan documents are a multi-page document. We had a one-page form that says that they have to sign and date and attach documentation of their plan. I think most people in fiscal services in our department would say it's about as simple as we could make that and still have oversight and proper management of the funds. So we did work very hard, Senator, to make it simple, both on ourselves, but even more so on the business that might be applying for that assistance.
Senator Manager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was Ronald Reagan that said the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
I'm here to help you.
But this, you know, my constituents are telling me they're not sure they can afford much more help from us. And I think rather than raise their income tax and raise their property tax and do all that, they would probably get along without this grant.
Probably take the flood relief away from them too, if you want, or the tornado relief away from them. If you don't, you know, you don't want that either. We could, you know,
it's here.
Just let me know, you know, because I've got all kinds of projects up in my district that could use some funding.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I, no disrespect intended, I do appreciate the doing for Hugo what was done for every other city and that in the same situation in the state over the years.
That money's got to come from somewhere, you know.
It did. And I, there are times in emergencies and when we have a responsibility to do that. But I don't think this equates to the Hugo tornado or to the floods in western Minnesota. And I don't think that
you
this
may,
particular
you may be
grant...
Right about, you may be right about that, but your rhetoric is equating it to it.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you were offended by that, I'm sorry. I apologize.
I'm not offended. I'm just telling you what you're saying.
Well,
your taxpayers don't want taxpayers' money to fund the Hugo tornado. You know, that, I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. So I don't know if we want to get into this type of a rhetoric right here because we're just trying to find out what the governor's budget recommendations are. And it's okay to be for or against the governor's budget recommendations, but to demagogue this, I think, is a little bit inappropriate.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, I had to leave, but have we heard from all the witnesses under number one?
No, we haven't, and I don't. I think you guys are done, right? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Rick Cardenas and Katie McDermott, are you both here?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'll start, Katie.
Mm-hmm. Who wants to go first?
Oh, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Rick Cardenas with Advocating Change Together, and we have a grant from DEED also. However, we're not in VRS, so we're getting an extremely large hit on this, 17% of what we've received in the past. I know it could be easily rectified by putting us in VRS, and we would able to get that federal match. I don't know how we do that, but I would really be happy to accept that as an amendment here. We've had this program for 3 years now and go around the state, and it is not directly getting jobs for individuals, but it is preparing people for individuals. Individuals trying to develop independence and establishing themselves within the community. Many persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities have received enormous cuts over the past couple of years in all sorts of programs. DHS is cutting 6.5%, and many of the members of Advocating Change Together are worried that now they'll only be able to go to the dentist once a year, and they know they've gone at other times. But Advocating Change Together has been training folks in their civil and human rights for 30 years, and we have been lucky enough to gain some government funding over the past few years, and it certainly has helped the independence of persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So we would we know there has to be some cuts in the budget, and we just hope that ours isn't so large to diminish our program. I also have Katie, who would like to make a statement.
Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, my name is Katie McDermott, and I'm on the ACT board. And I worked at Merrick Training Facility for about 4 years. And 2 years ago, I involved in self-advocacy. I've done many trainings about my rights with ACT, and they have given me the encouragement and confidence to get a job in the community, which has helped me a lot. And now I'm working at Turnstiles Consignment Shop in Roseville. I think the programs at ACT are really important, and we should try to keep them all. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. And committee members, this is on that spreadsheet. It's on line 29. And I think what Mr. Cardenas is pointing out is that this is about a 17% cut to your program, and you don't mind getting a 3 or 5 or 6% cut, but getting hit that hard is
well, Mr. Chair,
and Senator Kubley.
Could we ask Ms. Cardenas how that might how might that impact the things that you do? And you know, I'm just looking for a little feedback on how that would impact the program that you deliver.
Well,
Mr. Cardenas.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, we go around the state, and it for sure is going to cut back a number of places, especially those long distances up north where we've made numerous trips over the years, and other trips probably out west where you are, that'll have to be reduced. And one of the good things and bad things about persons with developmental disabilities, there are programs throughout the state because so many of the areas need cheap labor. And not that I'm for cheap labor, but that's what you find at the for persons with intellectual developmental disabilities. And we're trying to help them to understand that their independence comes from their ability to request for better paying jobs.
Okay, thank you both very much. I appreciate your
thank
testimony.
You.
Department of Labor and Industry, Mr. Rakowski. And this starts on page 52.
Mr. Chairman, members Rakowski. Of the committee, my name is John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm here with our Chief Financial Officer, Cecilia Jackson, who will speak specifically to that area of the department which receives general fund appropriations, which, as you can see, is a very, very small portion of our overall budget, which is annually approximately $142 million. The vast majority of our department is financed through work comp assessment on all employers, some federal OSHA funding for our OSHA state plan, and a bit of workforce development fund money, and federal money also goes for our apprenticeship program. And last is our construction code and licensing division, which is funded entirely by licensed tradesmen, plumbers, electricians, pipe fitters, and the like, who pay an annual license fee, as we also extract permit fees and plan reviews. So with that, just as a reminder, the department does not, quote, live off the general fund like some other agencies do, but we were asked to prepare a general fund cut, and it is strictly in the labor standards unit, which is a important but small part of the department. I'll turn it over to Cece Jackson.
Ms. Jackson, will you address Mr. Rakowski's statement just now, who that full-time equivalent position is? Is it prevailing wage enforcement? What is that?
That is in our labor standards section, and it is a prevailing wage position. The one FTE, we have currently had that vacant due to the employee's medical leave of absence. And we do have reassigned that employee's work. We don't expect that that employee will return to work. And so the other employees within that division have absorbed that workload. So we look at this as a minimal reduction because we have already shifted the work around to other employees. Within this labor standards section, they are responsible for the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act and Minnesota Child Labor Standards activities. The budget reduction in 2000, supplemental budget reduction in 2010 is $16,000. That is 3% of our unspent dollars. And in 2011, it is 3% of the full year's general fund dollars, which is $26,000. And then from then on, it is a $26,000 reduction. This reduction will mean time delays in processing complaints, as well as reductions in the number of complaints and cases that we can actually handle.
Do you have a backlog there already?
Yes, she does. Rosalind Wade is our division director in that section, and it seems that at any point in time there is a backlog.
Do we know how many cases are backlogged?
From my last speaking with her, it's about, from at that time, it was about 300 cases.
Sounds like we need more people. Okay.
That would be appreciated.
Okay. What's next? Are there any, maybe there are other questions, Senator Kielash?
Yeah, a backlog of 300 cases means how many months does an applicant have to wait until they get some kind of service from the department?
Usually what happens is, Mr. Chairman and Senator Kielash, an employee who's been terminated, an employer, and Senator Parisow and I talked about a constituent of hers who is currently in the process of meeting with the department over some alleged payroll deductions, et cetera, et cetera. It depends on the case. If it's strictly, I think my employer owes me 2 weeks back pay after being terminated, that's going to not, you know, those are more cut and dry template kind of investigations. The one, the constituent of Senator Parisow, it's much more complicated and it'll take longer, and yet he wants some resolution. And so if we had more people, it would obviously take less time. But it depends on the complexity of the number of cases within a company or if it's just an individual employee.
Mr. Chair, what I don't quite understand or is not clear to me is that if a complicated case, does their issue get addressed right away? Does that mean we're taking the personnel there and adding more to their caseload so that none of them get processed as quickly? Or is it in a lineup so that, you know, 3 weeks from now, a month from now, maybe I can get to this more complicated case? I'm trying to find out what kind of services and how long people that are, in many cases, employment and getting their checks is a crisis for them. So,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll double check on this, but I've asked her this question, the director, and it's as they come in the door. There's complexity.
So as we add caseload on, that means everybody has to wait longer while they.
And Mr. Rakowski, are they taking other jobs on other than prevailing wage jobs? I mean, is there other priorities within the department, like education or whatever it is they might be doing? Is there something else that's preventing them from taking on these cases?
Mr. Chairman, the Labor Standards Unit deals strictly with the Fair Labor Standards Act. So if people call in regarding overtime, child labor laws, now we've added the last few years of prevailing wage enforcement. And to be, I think you guys are looking for some blunt facts here. Prevailing wage has consumed her investigatory powers in the last couple of years because we just got that. And it's added on another layer to the traditional child labor law violation investigations. So they're much more complicated. So, and you gave us three full-time people in the first year of the biennium, and since then we've been having to cut back because that's a general fund function.
I guess I'm trying to figure out if they're all doing prevailing wage or if they're doing something else besides prevailing wage, because there's something that the department has determined to be a priority over these prevailing wage cases.
Mr. Chairman, she has at least a couple of investigators who do exclusively prevailing wage. The rest do prevailing wage and all other labor standard violations.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. You can continue. Are you done?
We were told to keep it short.
Okay. Anybody from the audience that wants to comment? Okay. Let's see. Thank you very much. Housing Finance Agency, page 51.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Related to Mr. Nelson that was up here before?
Pardon?
Are you related to Mr. Nelson that was up here before?
I am not related to him, Mr. Chair. Maybe long ago. Good afternoon. I'm Jeanette Blankenship with Housing Thank Finance. You should have in front of you fairly soon, if not already, our slide handout in addition to page 51 where our budget is located. I'm here to present the supplemental budget recommendations for the agency. So first, I'll share with you our principles that guided the recommendations. Then I'll give an overview of the recommendations and rationale for where we took the reduction from, and finally present the impact of the budget reduction on the programs. So with this packet of slides, there is an appendix. I'm not going to go into detail on it, but it's for your information to review at a later time. We started the supplemental budget process with the same three principles that we used last year in creating the 2010-11 budget. We want to preserve programs that serve the most vulnerable populations, such as Bridges and Housing Trust Fund. And we know these programs serve folks, many with disabilities. They don't have anywhere to turn. And we want to protect these programs that leverage non-state resources, particularly federal resources. And finally, we want to continue programs that allow us to have progress on the business plan and long-term homelessness. So to these three principles, we added a fourth for the supplemental budget process to honor previously made commitments to the maximum extent possible. We have some programs that we have committed funding for both 2010 and 2011 and did not want to renege on our commitments that people are counting on. For example, Three Rivers Community Action down in southeast Minnesota, they've already committed all of their rental assistance for this year. We don't want to take that funding back. There are families that need that and are counting on that. In the 2009, the base budget for fiscal years 10 and 11 signed into law was $86.768 million. The supplemental budget proposes a 6% reduction for the agency from fiscal year 2010 funds that have not yet been disbursed, and 6% from all 2011 funds. This totals $2.061 million for 2010 and $2.603 million in 2011.
So can you explain that a little bit further? From you said 2010 that have not been disbursed yet. So these are funds that are in housing housing funds that would be given out for projects to build houses or whatever. But in 2011, there's general fund money involved in that also? Your agency operating budget, is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, we have no operating budget for the agency that comes from general fund. That's completely covered by agency resources. So the funding that's cut for 2010, we've made a lot of commitments for 2010, but have not dispersed a lot of that. You know, with construction, it takes a while, so we've committed on projects. Or, for example, rental assistance, we pay it quarterly, so it's been committed for the year, but it's dispersed quarterly. So there's still quarters that have not yet been dispersed, but that money's committed. So our direction was to take 6% from the undisbursed funds,
okay,
which is a bigger number than the uncommitted funds for 2010. And then for 2011, we were directed to take 6% from the total amount, whether it was committed or not. Obviously, none's been dispersed for 2011.
Okay, I was referring to the general fund of your particular agency where you pay people from and everything, and so I was wondering if that's what the 2011 But you're talking about all the funds because they haven't been committed yet. No one's applied for them, and you haven't given them out. So there's more there than ever is in 2010.
Correct. And, Mr. Chair, again, none of our – we don't use any general fund to pay people at the agency.
Well, how do you pay people at the agency?
We use – because we issue bonds, mm-hmm. and there's a small spread on that, we are able to pay all of our agency salaries from that.
And that's what I was referring to, but I said general fund at the agency, referring to you guys particularly, not the state's general fund. So it's my bad.
No problem, yeah. Mr. Chair. We call it agency resources, if that's a helpful term for you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Okay.
And I want to remind you, this $4.664 million is the total for the 2 years, and that's in addition to a $256,000 unallotment for each year. So $512,000 for the 10 and 11 is the unallotment. That's an addition. So as of January 31st, nearly three-quarters of our fiscal year 10 funds have been committed, while only 58% of the fiscal year was completed, to my point that we've committed more than the distance in the year. So the reduction will come from two places. For fiscal year 10, the $2.061 million will be taken from the Preservation Affordable Rental Investment Fund, or PARIF, as I'll refer to it. And in fiscal year 11, $1.603 million will come from PARIF, and $1 million will come from the Rental Rehabilitation Program. The PARIF program, just to remind you, provides below-market interest deferred loans to help cover the costs of preserving rental housing with the long-term project-based federal subsidies for rental housing that are in jeopardy of losing these federal subsidies. So you've got projects out there that have federal subsidies. Think of a Section 8 project, for example. We want to make sure that building stays in a federal program. We use PARIF funding to help preserve that building, to keep it in the federal program, and that leverages federal dollars. And the Rental Rehabilitation Program provides interest-free deferred loans for affordable rental housing developments to make needed health and safety repairs to the property. So with the supplemental budget reduction and an allotment, the available funding from Minnesota Housing in fiscal years 10 and 11 is $81.6 million. The rationale for reducing these two programs, PARIF and Rental Rehabilitation Program, is from two factors. First, last year when we were budgeting, we got word that there are new federal guidelines about elevators, and the federal code was going to increase dramatically the cost of upgrading elevators in our buildings that we fund. The actual data is coming in now, and it's lower than anticipated. So while this cut is still a cut, it's not as bad as it could have been because we had budgeted a lot more per unit because of this elevator cost. It's going to be lower. And secondly,
is that the effect of the recession?
Mr. Chair, part of it, I think we were oversold what the cost would be, and part may be lower bids.
Okay.
And the second factor that helps us sustain this cut in the preservation programs is that we've been working with the Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security, and the Community Action Partnership Agencies on the weatherization program and figuring out how some of that can be used for multifamily rental properties. Under the Recovery Act, the weatherization program in Minnesota received 13 times more money than it had the previous year. And so while this program will serve many more low-income homeowners, it also opens up opportunities to use to conserve energy in affordable rental housing, reduce energy costs for low-income renters, and help preserve this affordable housing. The U.S. Department of Energy and HUD are making it easier for weatherization providers to serve federally assisted rental properties by eliminating the need to verify tenant income again. It saves time and removes this redundancy. The new federal rule goes into effect at the end of this month. So we're optimistic that the affordable rental properties will receive weatherization services as a result of this change. So those are two factors that allow us to sustain that in preservation.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On that subject, thank you, Ms. Blankenship. The question has come up. Have we been able to make that leap in Minnesota and provide that weatherization for low-income multifamily housing in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. At this point, not much progress has been made from what we can tell. A lot of folks have been waiting for this federal rule to go into effect. They could have been moving ahead and had every tenant sign a application for weatherization. But at this point, we're still, it's a really slow start, and we're hopeful that after the rule goes into effect on the 24th, that we'll see a lot more activity there. And I'd be happy to update you in the future on that progress.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Senator.
Where, yeah, I've been hearing this kind of over the transom and, you know, about not just this part of the weatherization program and the dollars coming to Minnesota that aren't being spent quickly or efficiently, but across the board. You know, you don't have to answer this, but I'm just wondering, and we can figure this out maybe as a committee or maybe over in the Energy Committee or the Environment Committee, you know, kind of where things are kind of getting bogged down. I'm a little bit stumped. I mean, I keep hearing about we're about there, oh, and then suddenly we have to deal with a rule or a reg that admin thought up, and we're about there, and, Commerce thought up something, or the action, community action agencies. So I'm frustrated and I'm anxious, especially if we could kind of be all queued up, ready to go, and we're not. And so there's going to be a lag, and I'll be really curious to know what the impact will be on the Housing Finance Agency's budget if we're not able to release those dollars and spend them effectively and efficiently. And also, do we lose out? Do we lose our if we're not able to spend these dollars effectively and efficiently by a certain, I mean, do they go get sucked back into Washington, D.C. and redistributed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I believe all funds need to be expended by 2012, but they have some goals to meet, I think, by this fall of 2010, that maybe three quarters might need to be spent. So I'm not sure we're on track for that, but I'm sure OES could give you an update.
Thank you.
Okay.
And just a few more items. The impact. The impact of this budget reduction will result in 336 fewer units being preserved under PARIF. We have determined that for every dollar of PARIF funding put into a property, we preserve $5.70 of federal assistance. If each of these units were not able to be preserved and they left the federal assistance program, then we would lose $20.8 million in federal assistance. Many of these properties may just defer this maintenance and stay in the program. But if all these 336 units were to leave the federal assistance program, that's what we would lose in federal funding in the state.
That's the $20.8
million? $20.8 million, yes.
And you've tried to not lose any federal funding?
We tried.
Right? So this particular one here, is it just didn't work? I mean, we're going to lose the money?
Mr. Chair, again, much of the maintenance may be deferred. So it's not that's the worst-case scenario, is that if all those units were to leave the federal Section 8 program, for example, that funding would be lost. I don't think that would happen.
Okay.
But that's the worst-case scenario, if we were to lose those. And then in 2011, with the rental rehab program, we estimate 75 fewer units would be preserved through this program, though it's a tentative projection based on average funding when it was a home program. You recall that last year we switched funding sources for this program from federal to state and moved the state funding to rental and the federal program to homeownership. So that's just a tentative projection. So I just want to close with reminding you of how important state appropriations are to serve low- and moderate-income Minnesotans. All of our state-appropriated programs serve households that are below 50% of the statewide median income, or $36,450, with the exception of the down payment program for first-time homebuyers. The only way we're able to serve households with such low incomes is through state appropriations. The agency does not receive any funding from the state budget, as I said, to pay for our operations. So all the funding in our budget here goes directly to serve the housing needs of low- and moderate-income Minnesotans. With that, I'll stand for further questions.
Any questions or comments? So is this the first time by yourself in front of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I believe so in the Senate.
Okay. And I called you Nelson when you first came up because somebody put it on the agenda. It was probably Cap's fault.
That's okay. Sure.
That's not your
staff. It's my maiden name, I'm fine being
okay,
a Nelson
all right,
as well.
See, so we got it right then. Okay. All right. Anybody have any questions of Ms. Nelson Blankenship? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, is anyone going to testify on this?
Does anybody else want to make any comments? Anybody that wants? Anybody else?
Well, if okay. not, I just okay. wanted to
Senator Dibble, go ahead.
Comment. I, you know, I'm just looking at, you know, 336 potential units that we would lose, you know, loss of, you know, $20.8 million. You know, this is a those are significant. We need to think about, you know, that's 336 families, you know, that may be looking for affordable housing that's not available. Well, we've struggled with this preservation issue quite a bit in my district, very successfully, and I'm really pleased with the results that we've gotten. And I fear for, and that's a lot of folks, and the implication on other parts of the budget, Senator Berglund's budget, education budget. You know, there's a lot of kids in these families. We just need to contemplate.
The workers do the work. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee member, my name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the public policy director at Homeline. And I don't have details, but can certainly promise to get them to the committee. I just want to try to make a little bit more real about the loss of the preservation dollars, what that means for tenants and for communities. I hope that the units that we can't support right now defer improvements on properties rather than leave Section 8. But what that sometimes means is that the quality of the housing that low-income people are living in is less than the quality than they deserve and less in quality than the neighborhoods that these buildings are in would find acceptable. And so just note that we're seeing a further deferment of housing stock, of the quality of housing stock, and improvements for people who they deserve to be living in someplace better. As an example, we have Homeline organizes with properties. Homeline organizes with tenants who are living in properties where a landlord may be thinking about exiting the federal subsidy program, and in some ways to entice them to stay in, we find ways to provide improvements to the properties and help improve the quality of the apartments. And sometimes these improvements are things like improvements to a heating system or an elevator or, you know, something to make the property work better in the long term. And those not making those improvements just leave the tenant suffering with the problem for a longer period of time. And we are coming up on a number of units across the metro area, I know, and I can also get some information statewide, that where landlords may be deciding whether or not they want to continue to operate in a federally subsidized program, PERF dollars help entice them to stay in. And if we take those resources away, we may this may also, you know, lead prospective landlords to be thinking that the state and federal commitment to keeping them inside the federal program is just not there. So we have huge concerns and would be happy to provide data to the committee about where we're seeing impending negotiations and the need for these resources.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the witness. Do you know what is the relationship of Section 8 rent to market rent? Is it usually higher or lower or the same?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vandiver, the usual practice is the tenant pays 30% of their income for rent, and anything that is in excess of that would be paid for through the federal subsidy. And there are, I think, based on community, different standards for how high that rent can be. In practice, you're usually working with rents that are lower than rents in the surrounding area, but there are some communities across the state where it might be slightly higher. I've certainly heard of a couple communities from testifying in the House where there might be a slightly higher rent, but usually you're dealing with lower rents.
Mr. Chair, is there somewhere where I could get the like a listing of maybe not who's paying it, but what actual rents are in different cities? Is there somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vandiver, There's fair market rents that are published by HUD, and I'd be happy to send you a link to those. They change across communities in the state, as Mr. Dahl mentioned.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Do you want to make some comments?
Yes.
Say your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers. I did have a couple comments regarding the supplemental budget. I wanted if the...
Is this on the housing part?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
If the agency can identify which parts of the appropriations requested have already been earmarked for organizations, that once it's passed, it's already gone. We had that problem with the last budget as far as the language. We thought that there would be competitive RFPs, but there weren't because the money was already predetermined. The second issue is under the HECAT funds. There are a number of agencies who made applications for the HECAT funds that were not given grants. Among them were all the Asian organizations. One organization had been applying for 4 years, and they do understand the need as far as the Asian community needing the funds for the counselors and the training. Because right now the only thing that was available to the Asians who wanted to do counseling or the Asian agencies was to send their people at their own expense to NeighborWorks America trainings, which were all out of state, from California to Washington, D.C., Memphis, and Louisiana. Although it's required training for Minnesota, they couldn't get the training here in Minnesota. So we would like some of the funds to be, if they aren't going to get the grants through the HECAT money, to be set aside for those trainings. And that would be the request. Thank you.
And these are requests of the agency. And Ms. Blankenship, can you kind of, I don't know if you need to comment now or if you would like to.
Mr. Chair, on the targeted funds, for the most part, there's no statutory appropriation for any specific organizations. We do. A number of our programs are competitive, such as the Challenge, where you have a RFP process once or twice a year. Other ones have a rolling application process for administrators like CASA or others. And then on the HECAT funds, there is also a competitive process, and I'm not sure of all the requirements. I'd be happy to get Ms. Lee those for how applicants are evaluated.
Okay.
And I know it is a competitive process to administer these funds, and we have a pretty strong, robust network across the state. So I'd be happy to follow up with her.
Okay. Maybe you can email the committee members the answers to her questions, too.
Sure.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'll follow up with her as far as more specifics as to, you know, where the funds had already been predetermined prior to the budget being passed last time, and also, again, we would restate our request that there'll be certain set-aside money for programs that have these counselors available to be trained to access money for scholarships. Even if they're trained at the Homeownership Center, I think is one that requires it, and I understand the Minnesota Mortgage Prevention Council was asked not to provide it, but they also charge. So if some of those funds... We understand if they don't get the grants under the HECAT, that there is the money that's within that HECAT for trainings, and that a portion of it be set aside for those.
And that might be a policy change that we may have to take a look at.
Thank you.
Probably in the next biennium, probably, but I don't know if we can do it this time or not. So, but we'll take a look at it. Okay. Thank you very much. What do we got next? Historical Society.
Say
whatever you want.
I'm just joking.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Kier, and I'm Deputy Director for External Relations at the Minnesota Historical Society.
This is on page 50, members.
Yep. And with me today is Michael Fox, the other deputy director for the Society for Programs in Education. We just wanted to take a few minutes before you today, and we understand to talk about the governor's proposed operating budget. And we know that this is the first step in the budgeting process. We do recognize the seriousness of the budget situation. We are prepared to do our part for the Minnesota Historical Society. As you can see from page 50 of the handout, the Society has received a $217,000 reduction for the remainder of 2010 and a $501,000 reduction for FY11. And then the out years, it's $501,000 for each year carried over to the next biennium. And when you include the governor's unallotment, that comes out to approximately over $1.3 million for the next biennium as we look out into the future.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage of that budget, what
I'm
percentage
turn
cut
it over to
be?
Mr. Fox to give you more details.
Mr. Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson. For the record, my name is Michael Fox. I'm Deputy Director for Programs. The answer is if you include the governor's unallotment figure, that's a 4% reduction for the Society.
And does this result, let's see, the reduction would impact open hours staff? does it result in any layoffs?
Mr. Chairman, while we haven't gotten to the level of analysis to say specifically where it would happen, I would say that my ballpark estimate is if you're looking at the $500,000 level in FY11, we'd be talking about 10 FTE positions being eliminated.
Would you have to actually eliminate the positions? Are there vacant positions that won't be filled, or are there people that could be either retiring or something where they wouldn't be losing their income?
Mr. Chairman, since we have not worked through this, I can't say about retiring staff, and people retire on their own schedule, so we can't always anticipate them. We do have a number of positions that are vacant. Deputy Director Kyer and I have been very diligent in reviewing all new hires from the general fund, and so we do have some vacant positions. So I'm assuming that at least some of that would be absorbed by positions that are not currently filled.
We do. Approximately 80% of our appropriation does go to staff, so that's where that reduction would come from.
And are there any cuts in any pass-through grants or anything like that that you know?
No, as we understand, there's no reduction in the pass-through.
Okay. All right. Any Senator Kielash?
Will this reduction cause some of the historical sites not to open or to be mothballed temporarily till funding? Because that's, I know some of them are seasonal, so. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, at this point I can't answer that, but my hope is that that will not happen, that we'll be able to, probably through a reduction of hours, but not closing sites completely.
And that's how we addressed it the last time.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What do we got next? Film board. Page 50 also. Is anybody from the film board here?
Members of the committee, Sue will be right here. She just...
Okay, well, let's go to the Humanities Commission then. You snooze, you lose. Mr. Romanstein, thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman. Members, good afternoon. I'm Stanley Romanstein. I'm president of the Minnesota Humanities Center. We provided two handouts for this afternoon's meeting, both multicolored. One that says making an impact in local communities through the humanities, and the other the impact of Governor Pawlenty's budget recommendations. If I could comment just very briefly, the Humanities Center receives a $250,000 general fund appropriation to support its work. About half of that amount goes out annually in grants and support for smaller organizations around the state. We support, for example, 12 learning and retirement organizations in small communities across Minnesota. They reach about 40,000 people with educational opportunities, volunteer opportunities. We work with a number of organizations like the Minnesota Machinery Museum in Hanley Falls, the Iron World or Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm. We work with small organizations across the state with those grants and support, and we provide rigorous professional development for K-12 educators, the kind of professional development that is proven by research to make a difference in closing the achievement gap for Minnesota's students.
Mr. Rolston, I have to interrupt you because
Mr. Chairman.
Because I have to tell the committee members that if you haven't been to my office, I have an Emmy in my office that these guys won as a result of this yellow box here that's on the Building of America. They did a documentary on the Building of America, and it was mostly a history of the Iron Range. That they did it in conjunction with the Minnesota Public Television, and they won an Emmy. So if anybody wants to come up to my office and hold the Emmy up and actually show it, it's pretty neat. You can come and take a picture with it if you'd like.
So I was going to say, do you have a camera ready?
I got it's camera ready. Okay, go ahead.
You're doing your own movie, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The state support, while relatively small, provides leverage for us for millions of dollars in private donation. We deliver a return of about 14 to 1 on every dollar the state invests in us. The governor's recommendation is that all general fund support for the Humanities Center be eliminated for both beginning in 2011 and continuing on into ensuing years. The cuts, if they are sustained, would affect about 200,000 people a year. We would not be at the Minnesota Machinery Museum in Hanley Falls. We would not be working with retired adults throughout the state. There would be a direct economic impact on our professional development work. It's likely that we would close the Minnesota Humanities Center, the historic part of the Gillette Children's Hospital here in St. Paul. It would result in a loss of 7 full-time positions on the Humanities Center staff. In short, I think that the governor's recommendations would have a disastrous impact on our work and on our ability to reach Minnesotans across the state, and the savings to the state would be relatively modest.
$3.5 million impact on the, does that sound about right?
That's about right.
On the
$250,000.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for the presentation on the, what was the level of reduction, just remind me, on the last year's budget? Did the Humanities Commission receive any reductions to their budget for this last budget round?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, we did not receive a reduction for the last. For the 2008-09 biennium?
For 2010.
For 2010, we did not receive a reduction in the $250,000.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Dibble?
Our total appropriation, Mr. Chair, to the Humanities Commission is $250,000?
Yes.
So we're zeroing them out again.
Again.
Like we did a few years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Questions, anybody? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Should we make her wait till last now? Film board. Welcome to the committee. Say your names for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Lucinda Winter, and I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota Film and Television Board.
I'm Christine Walker, a local film producer and a former member of the Minnesota Board.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us. You have or are receiving right now a handout which highlights more than I will cover here. I will try to hit some of the high points. On page 50 of the supplemental budget recommendations, Explore Minnesota Tourism are the recommendations for that affect both our operating budget and our snowbait rebate program for film production in the state. I'll address them sort of simultaneously. Just as a brief overview, though, we are the state's film commission and have been since 1983. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We operate with public dollars in the amount of $325,000 a year currently. Those are matched 3-to-1 with private dollars. So for every $10 we receive from a company or private individual, we can access $30 of state money. So we do see ourselves as very entrepreneurial, and we leverage public dollars with private contributions to accomplish our mission, which is... let's see, what is our mission? Our mission is really to build and promote the state's production industry. The strongest tool we have for doing that is our snowbait program, and both the snowbait program and, as I said, our ops budget are affected. Our operations budget in this proposal would be taken to zero as of July 1st. So what that means is that the Minnesota Film and Television Board would no longer exist. And, of course, that would be very devastating for our film industry here. This is an industry that employs about 4,000 people in the state full-time. There are about three, depending on whose numbers you believe, 380 or 400 firms engaged in production, post-production, and sound recording in the state. It's a state where you compete with other states for business that brings new dollars and jobs. And just point number three, I think, is worth noting. Since July of 2007, the last two fiscal year biennial period where we ran our snowbait program, and we do administer it with oversight from tourism, but we're the first line of administration for the program out of our office. Snowbait created 338 full-time equivalent Minnesota jobs and generated Minnesota expenditures by people who came and bought services, hired people, rented hotels, location fees, all of the inputs for production. Minnesota expenditures were $15,600,000. Reimbursements and administrative fees totaled $2,599,000 for a cost per job of $7,689. This compares favorably with other states and federal incentive programs based on the cost per job created. The program, it should be noted, reimburses only for payments made to Minnesota citizens, people who live and work here, and to Minnesota companies. You have to have a zip code in Minnesota in order for the expense to be reimbursed. Snowbait attracts studio features and commercials that are of the sort of budget that they are union jobs, Teamsters, SAG, AFTRA, then the Cinematographers Guild, all the guilds, and all those unions and guilds pay retirement and health benefits. These are good jobs. So I thought a couple examples would be interesting and helpful to you. A Serious Man, which was shot here in the fall of 2008, was a snowbait recipient. Direct expenditures, and this is over about a four-and-a-half-month period, were $6.5 million. Total wages paid to personnel was $3,195,000. And income taxes collected at 8% was about $255,000. So, and people who worked on that movie, whether they were a Minnesota resident or not, all paid Minnesota income taxes. Everybody does, as do all the above-the-line people, which is like the baseball player phenomenon. You come into town, you work here, you're payrolled here, you pay Minnesota income taxes. The crew for A Serious Man was about 130 people. Hotel room nights totaled 4,400. Lodging total, because they also rented apartments and condos, was $339,000, and the reimbursement was $1.2 million on all of that. And I didn't calculate the indirect economic impact. I'm sticking with direct. The Convincer, which is a movie that's in its second week of production, and that is a movie being produced by Christine Walker's company, Work, Work, Works, which is a company that has opened here in Minnesota 2 years ago. It's currently in production, and it's shooting all over. As you can see, I've named just a few of the locations where they're shooting. It has a cast of three stars: Greg Kinnear, Alan Arkin, and Billy Crudup are the principals. Estimated Minnesota spend, including payroll, is $2,145,000. Minnesota payroll, 1,363, so over a million, and Minnesota Income Tax paid, this is an estimate based on their application to Snowbait, because this too is a Snowbait program, is $109,000. Estimated lodging room nights, $580 for $55,000 in room night fees, and their reimbursement would be in the neighborhood of $320,000, depending on when the actual receipts come in.
You couldn't have brought any of the stars here?
They're all shooting right now. On a farm right now.
They're in Hastings right now on a farm that's been rented that was vacant.
Isn't this the one that was supposed to be shot on the range?
Well, they looked all over. That's a whole other meeting. But
is it at the winery?
Pardon me?
Is it at the winery?
No. What winery?
One of the wineries?
Oh, we did look there, yes.
Yeah, you
but
did
we're not shooting there.
Yeah. I didn't know that they
caught it.
Yeah. But anyway, so
Laura wants to know where Greg Kinnear is.
Downtown Minneapolis.
Yeah, he's in downtown.
She gave him up too.
We have had some calls, so there have been sightings. But our Snowbait program, there's two issues with this, obviously both of which are serious. And we have I have a staff, including me, of five, and all of that would be eliminated. But the problem, there's a short-term problem, which is that our ops are cut. Snowbait has been cut in this proposal from $1.225 million for this fiscal year, to $525,000. And as in my point six, that is less than we have earmarked for production. So there's the $1.225 is in the bank account, and we have approved projects, including the convincer, of $796,000. So we have a gap between what the governor's proposal is for our Snowbait funds after an allotment and what we've actually. Now, it's not a contractual obligation. Our attorney general suggested when we set up the program that's a bad idea for this very reason. But we do write a letter of approval for any project, be it a film or a documentary, a TV series, whatever, that they've been approved for the program. So what, in effect, we would have to I'd have to go back to these projects and tell them that they will not be some of them, and tell them that they're not receiving their funds, which
Senator
is
Olson.
Serious.
Hang on, Senator Olson.
Oh, I can wait till the end.
So anyway, the point is, we are one of only three film commissions in the U.S. that is not a full-time government agency. We are a very weird cat in that we are a nonprofit public-private partnership. That, for all these years, for the 26, 27 years we've been in, that's worked, because we've been able to raise the money we need to match to get our state funds. There is no model for a film commission anywhere in the world that I've been able to find that is completely private. Film commissions are recognized and have the imprimatur of the government that in the geographic area where you operate. So if you become the private model, would throw you into being a trade association, and then you're working for a membership or the people who are keeping your doors open with contributions. You're not working for that jurisdiction. I could not find any model for a film commission that is completely private, because what you're supposed to be doing is promoting a geographic area without favor of any sort. You are trying to bring in jobs and bring in money.
Well, and you're competing with some other states that have some pretty hefty film programs where they're trying to attract these types of things because of the amount of economic impact that happens as a result of a movie in an area.
Exactly. And if, in fact, we were eliminated as of July 1st, there would still be Snowbait, there's a lag time between when the economic activity occurs. Like Christine, they've been spending money since January. They won't apply until they're wrapped in terms of bringing in all of their accounting, and we go over it all and then just determine exactly what the 15% is. So there will be no one as of July 1st to deal with the Snowbait reimbursement requests that will be coming in. Even if Snowbait is cut to 525, that will still lag past July. So that's a short-term problem. The longer-term problem is that without a film commission in our jurisdiction, you're presumed by anyone shopping to not have not have a viable industry and not have any support. It would be like going somewhere and looking for a CVB. You don't have one. Well, obviously, I can't bring a convention there because we don't have any infrastructure. It's sort of similar in that way. So while I'm very on board with taking a cut, I mean, that's what I was expecting, and certainly expect to get on board with the difficult times we're in, it would be very short-sighted to completely cut our office, and there'd be all the opportunity costs of lost business, and then 10 years down the road when we decide, gee, we should have a film commission in the state, you're starting over from less than zero. So I just feel it's a difficult decision.
General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we all say that we're concerned about jobs and the loss of jobs and what we need to do to try to stimulate job growth. And I was at a couple of opportunities to hear from the business community about this over the interim. I was in Bloomington at the Lodging and Hospitality Industry Conference. And one of the major concerns raised there was the lack of marketing that Minnesota does to market its hospitality industry statewide. Same story came at the tourism conference at Cragen's not very long ago. Comparatively, and I sit on the Explore Minnesota Tourism Commission, so I know that comparatively Minnesota spends a lot less to market its tourism industry, even though that's one of, you know, our primary industries in the state, than other states surrounding us do. I mean, if we want to compare ourselves to Wisconsin, for example. And we're losing jobs because of that. I would say we could do a lot better job probably where we have where we can do more to market ourselves. We could be doing a lot more to grow jobs and bring jobs to this area. And in terms of rebates or tax credits of one kind or another, so that's my first observation. My second observation is in terms of the tax credits that we give for part of that marketing process, I really wonder if we would ask, Labor and Industry Deed, who could do this for us, where we could take these various programs that we have that are supposed to stimulate jobs and stack them up next to each other in some kind of a grid or a graph and say what's working and what isn't. For example, I've heard that Job Z costs about $55,000 per job, but I don't, you know, those are longer-term jobs, perhaps. But by comparison, at $7,689 per job, like the film industry is doing, that seems like a pretty good deal. I mean, granted, those are maybe shorter-term jobs, but then if we were to look at how long they last, how much they're costing us, what the amount is that's paid for those, you know, in wages and benefits, the kind of jobs we're creating, we ought to have a better handle on, you know, which things are successful and which things aren't, and where it makes sense to put money and where it doesn't.
Good point, I think. Christine, did you want to say something?
Well, I just want to say I've been working in this.
I think you said your name earlier, but just
Christine Walker. Okay. I've been working in this industry for about 20 years and living in Minnesota for 19 of those years, and over the years, I've seen this community grow, and I've seen hundreds of people making a commitment to working in the film industry in this state. Over the course of my career, I've had to leave to work on different films, and 2 years ago, I decided, along with my partner, to invest in this community because of the people who worked here, because of the film commission. And we started our company. In 2 years, we've made 5 films. I've personally produced 5 films in the state over the 20 years. And we've made 5 films. 4 of those films, we raised all of the money from Minnesota, and 4 of those films we shot outside of Minnesota because of tax credits and other incentives that let us out of the state. We took investment money out of the state to make our films. We decided to make this film here because of our commitment to the crew and the community and because of the Film Commission's efforts. Having been a member of the board, I want to be here, and I see a lot of, there's a handful of companies who are working really hard to stay here. We have 10 employees now, all working in the film industry, and we want to build this, but it will be impossible without the support of a film commission. Everywhere you go, even if you want to shoot one shot, has a film commission, some representative who can show you, you know, who can talk about the state and show you around. And so I just urge you to please reconsider eliminating the funding for this position, or for this agency. I also want to either thank you or also re-encourage everyone to seriously consider the merits of the Snowbait program. You know, we were able to justify to our investors that it was worth shooting here, even though the tax credits are much less than, say, where we shot in Puerto Rico, where they're 42%, or in New York last year, where they're 30%. And here they're much less, but we were able to at least justify shooting here because of what we already have, and we're hoping that we can build upon that. But I mean, that, even though some people may say, oh, it's not enough, but it was enough to keep us here and enough to encourage us to invest in this community.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any questions or comments from anybody on the committee? All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate that.
Thank you for asking us.
The Arts Board, please. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and I appreciate the chance to be here today and give you a bit of an overview of the governor's budget proposal as it affects the Arts Board, and also to answer any questions, if I may, at the end. At the beginning, I'd like to say just a few words about the purpose and the structure of the board, just to give you a context for the work and why we do it. The Minnesota State Arts Board is a state agency. We exist in the executive branch. Our authorizing statute is MS Chapter 129D. It outlines a structure, a set of responsibilities that the board is responsible to carry out. We have 11 citizen board members who are appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. And by law, we have members from each congressional district, and we have at-large members. So we are set up to be a representative body. We also are, in law, directed to be the fiscal agent for a satellite system of regional arts councils that together serve every county, every community in the state of Minnesota. There are 11 regions. 9 of them are nonprofit organizations. 2 of them are based in regional development commissions. So together, the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils provide a system of financial assistance and services that make the arts available and accessible to Minnesotans all throughout the state of Minnesota. Turning to the appropriations information, which I believe is on page 47 of the governor's budget, you will see that, first and foremost, state funding is the principal source of revenue that the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils have. It's why we exist. It's why we were created. We are meant to be a system of fair, informed, citizen-driven distribution and investment of public funds across the state. So the state support really is the primary source of support. This year, in this biennium, we are receiving $8.6 million per year for fiscal 10 and fiscal 11, or for the biennium, $17.2 million. Just to put that in context, this level is 34% less than the appropriation that the state was making in 2000 and 2001, which was the high water mark for arts funding in the state of Minnesota. And that said, I want to be absolutely clear that we're grateful to everyone who around this table, in the Senate, in the House, who have worked very hard to provide
stable support and a stable level of appropriation even during these difficult times. We know that many of you have really helped to do that. As you will see on page 47, the governor has not proposed cuts to the Arts Board for fiscal 10. What he has proposed is that our budget would be reduced by $2.8 million for fiscal 11, taking us down to roughly $5.7 million. That's a 33% reduction in funding. For fiscal 12, the governor has proposed flip-flopping the numbers. So that reduction would be $5.7 million, or roughly 67% of the appropriation for the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. In fiscal 13, you'll see that the governor is recommending no general fund appropriation for the Arts Board or Regional Arts Councils, and presumably beyond into the future. And what the governor has proposed is that the board would cease to be a state agency in fiscal 2013, and would instead, his plan would be that we would transition to being a private nonprofit corporation. Since the governor announced his budget 2 days ago, we obviously haven't had a great deal of time to analyze the full impact of what these cuts would mean or to really seriously consider the options. But I can say with some certainty that we're a small agency. We have a staff of about 11 people right now. So we probably would have some job losses. But the real impact of this is to the organizations, the arts programs that are funded by the Arts Board. Because we pass through 93% of the funds that we receive from the state of Minnesota, the people who will be affected are, the organizations, pardon me, who will be affected are places like the Guthrie and the Minnesota Orchestra, but also Climb Theater, Headwaters School of Music in Bemidji, the Rife Center in Grand Rapids, the Wildwood Artist Series in Stillwater. Big and small arts organizations all across the state of Minnesota would be impacted. Some of those organizations may have a staff of one or two or five people. Some of them, like the major institutions, have 200 to 300 staff members who would be affected, and those jobs would be affected. And I'm speaking specifically about the Arts Board's funding. The Regional Arts Councils would have to make similar kinds of cuts because they, too, pass through most of the funding that they receive to organizations, to individual artists, and to arts programs in their communities. So we would have no choice but really to pass on the greatest amount of the pain and the significant cuts to organizations around the state. We absolutely understand that this is a time of dire economic uncertainty, and we know that the state and the whole country are dealing with that, and so no sector, including the arts, is immune. We all have to do our share, and we believe that one of the things we can do is to help in the economic development, help in the economic recovery for Minnesota. We may be a small tool, but we are a tool in the state's economic development tool belt. The arts, if you think about an arts organization as a small business, there are 1,400 small businesses who are counting in some way on some public funding to help them be successful. There are 30,000 artists in Minnesota who operate principally as sole proprietors, individuals who are trying to make a living, trying to pay for health care, trying to buy supplies and buy services that they need. The arts play a role in community economic development. They play a role in academic achievement. They play a role in developing the creative workforce and industries of the future. They play a role in tourism, which was just mentioned. And they help make this a state that's nationally visible across the country. So as you all tackle a really insurmountable, almost insurmountable challenge of balancing this $30-plus billion state budget, I hope you won't think that the $8 million that's appropriated to the arts is insignificant. It's really vital. It's vital to those organizations, and the general fund dollars that we provide, that the Arts Board provides, really makes a big difference in the health, the stability, and the vitality of those artists and arts organizations who are affected. And I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jens, maybe it's too soon for you to be able to know for certain, but just in the little time that you've had to be able to think about this, how likely do you think it is that you'd be able to replace the money that the state provides now to fund your organization through private sector donations or grants or wherever else there may be to look for additional funds if you were to become a private not-for-profit type of business or enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Yes. Chair? Senator Olson, I think you're right. It is too early for us to predict what sort of other philanthropic support there might be out there if the Arts Board became a nonprofit. The other thing that one needs to think seriously about is right now we're a service provider. We are a grant maker. We are the place that helps others do their work. And there might be a concern, or we might be seen as competitors if we now are going to the same foundations and to the same private donors who are supporting that work. And I think that there could be some confusion and some competition that would come into play that we would really have to seriously struggle with.
Any other questions? Senator Kulesh?
Ms. Gans, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Gans, I know that the Arts Board helped distribute some legacy dollars. And is that included in this budget? That we're talking about here. So if you're not available to do the legacy dollars, what other institution is there to try and help us distribute them around the state equitably?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Jens.
Senator Kulesh, this is only the general fund budget that's being proposed in the governor's proposal. The Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars are separate. And you're right, we are, the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils are receiving funding through that. It would be unclear to me what would happen with those dollars, whether there would be some other state agency to whom those dollars would be designated to serve the purpose that was laid out in the Constitution, which is to fund the arts, arts education, arts access. So I think that leaves a question on the table as to who would do that.
Can you, Mr. Chair, can you, how big was the fund this year that you distributed from the Arts Legacy Fund?
Mr. Chair? Yes. Senator Kulesh, the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils together this year are receiving $21.6 million from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Senator Dimmel.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just wanted to echo and support some of the points that Ms. Jens made and Ms. Winter made. We have a very successful arts community. We have very successful arts offerings all across the state, and that didn't happen by accident. We're unique, and it provides a unique element and aspect to our life and our offerings here that makes us a very attractive state, and it has a very, very direct positive economic consequence, and that's been demonstrated in study after study after study. Part of why that is because we've made a very explicit public commitment, and that's best articulated and expressed in the fact that the Arts Board exists. So to completely eliminate it and kind of spin it off as a separate standing 501c3, just sends a strong signal to our own population and to the larger world that we're just kind of getting out of the business. And to Senator Kulesh's point, we have these public resources now that are dedicated and devoted to this purpose, and it's most appropriately, I wouldn't feel super comfortable delegating that task to an arts board that isn't a creature of state government. So I think in a practical sense, in terms of accountability. And let me also just say that this is by no means all the dollars that get expended on the arts, but these are the dollars that leverage the other dollars that get spent. I used to be the executive director of two different nonprofit organizations, community-based, that did a small amount of community arts access, community arts programming, and this was often the first grant that we got, which was a tiny amount, but then allowed us then to approach the area businesses, community, and corporate and family foundations to do additional funding and attract arts curators in to help us provide those programs.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up with a couple different comments, too. One is that in terms of the pressure that's already there on nonprofits, I know that nonprofits are doing their best as well in a difficult economy to sustain their mission. But unlike what some people might think, or it's kind of easy to think that nonprofits or churches or someone else is going to be able to step in and fill the void when we step back from some of these things, from what I'm hearing, the factual impact of the economy on those organizations as well is just has made it very difficult for them to fulfill the missions that they already have. And so so their budgets are hurting as well, and they probably don't have any extra money to step up and fill this kind of void. And then the second thing I wanted to comment about is that it seems to me that I just kind of got a chuckle when there was the legacy amendment, the push for the legacy amendment, at least in my district. People were talking, would come up from the metro area sometimes and would talk about the partnership. You know, there'll be money for things we care about up north, like hunting and fishing and the woods and our lakes. But then there'll also be this money that we're going to give to the metro area for the arts. And I would get a bit of a chuckle out of that because the community where I live, the arts are extremely important. And it was almost like, you know, from a rural perspective, it seemed a little bit patronizing that sometimes people didn't realize that we have some civilization up in the Northwoods too, you know. But it's not just... I just want to underscore, it's not just the arts for their own sake, which is also important, but it's also really an economic driver in our area every bit as much as the hunting and fishing and the other things we also care about. We have a lot of people in my district coming there to retire. And these are people who enjoy the things that the arts provide in terms of quality of life and those opportunities. They're looking for those things when they're looking for places to come and retire, and from a tourism perspective, we've almost become more of a second home destination as opposed to the typical family resort experience, which isn't happening as much, unfortunately, as it used to be. So having these kinds of opportunities there in our communities is really important to the economic development, as well as for their own sake.
Thank you. Mr. Redmond.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Larry Redmond. I represent Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. I do not represent the State Arts Board or a governmental unit. I represent, through Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, the 1,300 arts organizations, by the way, which 60% are outside the metropolitan area. Also, the thousands, the many, many thousands of people in this state who participate and are involved, and not to mention many artists who earn their living in that way. I appreciate the chair giving me a moment or two to talk. I want to underscore a few points because we're frankly troubled by the appropriation, by the suggestions made in the supplemental budget. But let me begin by saying the arts community is extraordinarily concerned, like everybody is, and very aware of the very significant suffering and difficulties that every segment of our society is going through right now. There are the layoffs, the unemployments, the difficulties, the problems of people wondering how they're going to pay their light bill next month is not an abstraction to us. Frankly, it's a reality that is very true for everybody, including the people who work and are involved in these various arts organizations. Over the last many months, arts organizations, small, large, urban, rural, have made significant layoffs, furloughs. They've reduced salaries. They've done all these things. These are not abstractions. This is not just just a sympathetic response to other people, but this is a reality that the people who are involved in this are living with, like other Minnesotans are. So I wouldn't want any confusion to be made that we think we're special. We realize this is a problem that's throughout the state. However, the governor's proposal does not treat arts funding like it treats other aspects of this state budget. The cuts that Ms. Jens described, the 33% cuts, are 10 times the size of the cuts that are proposed to other state agencies. We think that those numbers are far, far beyond what is a fair proportion to be looked at in those numbers. Furthermore, the idea of the abolition or the conversion of the State Arts Board a few years down the road to a nonprofit corporation, we don't frankly understand the practical logic of such an entity. And echoing part of Senator Olson's question before, if I may. The concept of the state being involved in arts funding is to add another component to the very significant private money that is there. No one, whether it's individual artists, whether it's small groups, whether large groups, no one leaves money lying on the table in regards to funding these activities. It's a struggle to raise the money to provide arts activities for the children of our state, for the average age people of the state, for people of all kinds of different income levels. And there, it's not as if there is some source of money that will suddenly fill that void. So with all respect to Senator Olson's question, if I may before, I would suggest that they won't find that money anyplace else. That money will disappear. It will be a net loss to the benefit of the people of our state if it's not there, unless, perhaps, there's simply a shifting that takes place. And this new entity that the governor proposes that would exist in this nonprofit world would become a competitive entity raising money away from the small arts organizations, the rural arts organizations, the major organizations, and so forth. It'll just be a redistribution with inefficiencies and so forth that will serve no purpose in the state whatsoever. We don't understand the logic of why that would happen. Let me also add, if I may, that only in 2008, the people of this state, in unprecedented numbers, passed a constitutional amendment whose purpose was to secure an income stream, an additional income stream, to these dollars, because they said that these activities were so emblematic, so basic to the very essence of being a Minnesotan, that they wanted to see that that would be secured for the future. This was not just passed by a small margin. This amendment was passed by more votes than any other electoral issue in many, many years. In fact, I think perhaps the largest margin of any time in the history of our state. Now, of course, there were other issues attended to that. I don't want to be dismissive of those very important issues. But the public itself made that statement. And the legislature, as they designed that amendment, included language that specifically said that these dollars were to be additional dollars, and they were not to supplant other sources of funding. The other sources of funding that the constitutional language specifically spells out are the general fund dollars that, in fact, Ms. Jens was just describing. Now, the arts, as I said in the beginning, we don't think we're special. We don't think that there should be some special dealing with this versus other state agencies. But so, therefore, if there were to be a budget cut to those general fund dollars, to the extent that it was proportional to the other cuts, we would not sit here and object today. But a tenfold increase over those other numbers, we think, is a clear violation of the constitutional language that was adopted by no less than the public of this state in very clear numbers in that election. So our appeal to you today and to the House and the legislature to proceed on this is we're not suggesting not to cut us, but it ought to be relative, it ought to be proportional, it ought to be relative to those numbers, and we very much would argue that one should take a close look at that constitutional language whose ink is barely dry at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, that you might have. Okay.
Thank you. And I think we're getting a pretty good overview today of how hard cuts are to make and how people are impacted and how jobs are lost and economic impact is reduced. And it all goes in exactly the opposite direction of where we need to go as a state during this economy. And it's unfortunate, but I guess it's something we have to deal with as a result of the recession here. And it's not adding up. 2 + 2 isn't adding up to 4 here, from what I can tell. So I appreciate everybody coming in. Are there any questions of Mr. Redmond or any comments? Members, we have to come up with a budget reduction plan as a committee for these particular accounts that we have in this committee. So what I'm going to suggest is that if you have any ideas and you would like to get them to either Cap or me, or let us know what you think is a good way to do this. Go please feel free. We are probably going to start doing a bill next week that we'll forward to the full finance committee so that we can come up with some suggestions of some revenue reduction for this particular committee. And we'll be acting on it probably next week. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, how long do you think it would take to get one? I guess it probably would be deed to put together that kind of comparison that I was talking about in terms of how we're spending. I mean, would that be a complicated thing they'd have to do over the interim, or is that something they
might? They might have the figures already.
Okay, because if there's that kind of information out there, I'd really like to look at that so that we could make some kind of a really well-informed. I mean, for example, if we're looking at the money that's being spent on, whatever initiative it is, rather than getting politics involved in it, I think we should have hard, solid, factual information and then make decisions based on that.
And let's see. Best thing to do is to request it, okay?
So
I don't think anybody's here that's, I don't know if they're listening somewhere, but if you're listening, Senator Olson would like to let us know. And otherwise, we can make a formal request also. Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about targets for the different committees. If we're going to be acting on a bill next week, one, my concern would be that we don't have the February forecast. That'll be coming the following week. And then also, I'm not aware of any targets that have been established.
I think we got an idea from the finance chair where we need to go, and I think we're in probably about the 16 or 17 million area. I have a concern about the forecast also, but I think we resigned ourselves to the fact that we're going to be in a deficit situation regardless of the forecast, so we kind of want to get a handle on it early and see if we can get some things going. I guess that's the direction we're working in right now.
And then, Mr. Chair, are you aware of, I mean, when will are we going to receive those targets next week? Or are we just sort of going on that guesstimate by the finance chair? Or what are we operating under there?
Well, I think we're going on a guesstimate right now. I think it's probably as good a guesstimate as the governor's budget that he presented, because he looks like he's about $400 million short if the federal government doesn't do what they want him to. What he wants him to do, and so I think for right now we're probably going to try and make some proposed cuts here and see how that goes. Senator Dibble, I think you were next.
Is to this point? Okay.
Well, actually, it was.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you. My question is this what you're talking about doing intended to resolve the unallotments or include that, or
I think we'll be dealing with the $1.2 million shortfall that we are facing in before June 30th. So that's what we're aiming at.
I just wanted to follow up with Senator Olson. What are we asking for from Deed? Is it this jobs?
I guess what I would like to see, if we're looking at making cuts to an economic development. So, for example, if we have a program like JobZ and whatever other incentive programs there may be out there, looking at the effectiveness, the relative effectiveness of how those dollars are being spent before we make a decision about what should be cut or not.
In other words, what kind of bang for the buck we're getting?
Right.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I
Senator Dibble.
Don't want to impugn our fine state agencies and public employees, but I think there have been claims made about the effectiveness of some of our programs that haven't stood up to independent objective scrutiny. So maybe we could also maybe avail ourselves of the material out there that tells us what kinds of programs targeted
wherever
have,
it might
have.
Come. Well, for example, Mr. Chair, I think the auditor did an evaluation of JobZ, but I'm hoping that there's other, I'd rather get as broad a spectrum of that information as we can from wherever right. the source is.
Well, I have some of that, so I'll share some
okay.
of that research.
Okay. That's probably a good idea. And some of the stuff we heard today, like the Film Board and the Arts Board and the Humanities Commission, they're not part of DEED, so we heard some pretty significant economic impact from some of the jobs that they might be losing. And so you might not hear all of what this committee deals with if you were to
ask DEED to do something.
Well, okay, Mr. Chair, and so maybe some of these agencies where the cuts are being proposed have that kind of information internally, just like the little bit that we saw for the film board.
Yeah.
If we could.
I think you saw a $3.5 million impact from the $250,000 of the Humanities Commission. So mm-hmm. you have a pretty good handle on some of it, Senator Dibble.
And just one other suggestion, Mr. Chair, maybe informally, you could poll us or CAP could get in touch with us and ask us, kind of what, you know, similar to Ms. Blankenship's presentation, what kind of principles or values might we want to see upheld in, you know, in the kinds of cuts that we make in terms of implications for jobs and effectiveness, whether or not we're foregoing additional dollars that we leverage, federal dollars, that sort of thing, making sure we're not balancing our budget with federal dollars on the come, like we see in the larger proposal from the governor himself, you know, those sorts of things.
Okay. So we have a little bit of work cut out for us before Monday of next week, and we have two committee slots next week, so I'm not sure if we're going to get this done by Wednesday or not. That's the idea, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that is the idea. I know on Monday we have we'll be hearing additional testimony from Department of Commerce, as well as some other of the smaller agencies that are receiving cuts in the governor's recommendations. And we will be proceeding in assembling some sort of budget the remainder of next week.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, meeting adjourned.